Oh, I'm having a flashback. Oh, no.
Ladies and gentlemen, he's come a long way to be with us today. All the way from 1968, let's have a nice, friendly, personal welcome for Mr. Abbie Hoffman.
Hello, hello, hello. Well, let me introduce myself. My name is Abbie, and I am an orphan of America. I live in Woodstock Nation. Yeah, that's right. That's right. It is a nation of alienated young people, and we carry it around with us the same way that the Sioux Indians carry around the Sioux Nation with them. It is a nation dedicated to cooperation versus competition, to the idea that people should have a better means of exchange than property or money. There should be a basis for human interaction. Look, that was my answer that I gave during the trial of the Chicago 8 in 1969, when the judge insisted on knowing just where it was that I lived. He couldn't understand that I lived in a state of mind, the same state of mind that all of you live in. Right? That's why you're here today at this peace rally. You know what I'm talking about. Look, peace is my middle name. Okay, maybe it's not my middle name. If you're familiar with any of the things in history that I've been a part of, you probably know that I was no Gandhi. Okay, so look, I ended up in a courtroom for my crimes of peace. Look, some of you might remember the trial. Most of you probably have no idea what I'm talking about. So I'm gonna give you a little glimpse as to what the trial of the Chicago 8 was all about. Some considered it a monumental non-event, while others considered it a huge triumph for the hearts and minds of the American people. Me? I'm not really sure which way I look at it. All I know is I was fighting for a free America. Dig this, okay? In 1968, if there was a riot or there was some sort of protest happening, then it was responsible only for the local law enforcement. It was their deal. But after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., they passed the Civil Rights Act, which made it illegal to cross state lines with the intent to incite a riot. Dig it. The intent to incite a riot. Are you hearing this? The intent, not the action of, but the intent, the mere thought of it. So we were on trial for our thoughts. Can you believe that? It was made a federal crime. Come on, in 1861, when President Abraham Lincoln gave his inaugural address, he said, and I quote, "When the people shall grow weary of their constitutional amendments of the government, and of their constitutional right to amend the government, I should say, they shall exert their revolutionary right to dismember and overthrow the government." I tell you, Abraham Lincoln is lucky he did not give that speech in 1968, or he would have been right in the trial in the courtroom sitting right next to me. Because that is an insightful speech. That is a speech intended to incite a riot. But, you know, that was Abraham Lincoln. That was 1861. Me? I was in 1968, 1969. We were the first to be indicted for that provision. The funny thing is it wasn't even the Attorney General or the Justice Department. No, it was Mayor Daley in Chicago. And I'm not talking about the Mayor Daley that rules over Chicago now. No, because if it was still the same Mayor Daley, he would be as old as dirt. He'd be 108. I mean, the guy was born in 1902. No, the guy that rules now is Mayor Daley's son. Not Richard J. Daley, but Richard M. Daley. And if he stays in office until December 10th of 2010, this year, he'll be the longest serving mayor of Chicago. And you know who's number two? His father. Take that, right? Imagine that. The guy had some clout. He gets us indicted. His son's the mayor. You know, I don't know what to say about that. Politics, right? So, speaking of history repeating itself, Fresno, it seems to be sort of following in the same suit. I caught wind of a slew of emails. That's right. Now I'm using the internet. We didn't have that back in 1968, but I'm with the times now. Did you know that it's illegal for more than 40 people to walk on the sidewalk at a march? More than that requires a permit and must be applied for 30 to 45 days in advance at a permit cost of $328. Okay? The organizers must also reimburse the city for any of the costs or expenses that occur, and they have to follow the free speech routes established by police chief. I can talk. Police Chief Dyer, and they also have to pay for all of the traffic controllers in some estimated fashion that the police give an estimate for, and you gotta pay that in advance. I guess, I don't know, I mean, call me crazy, but isn't there a right to assembly in the Constitution? I don't know. Am I the only one who read that part? Is there some sort of fine print in there that says, well, you can only have the right to assemble if you line the pockets of the powers that be. I guess I must have missed that fine print. I'm gonna get my magnifying glass out for that one. Look, it was the same thing in Chicago in the summer of 68. We wanted to go to Chicago during the Democratic National Convention, or as I called it, the National Death Convention. And we, on the other hand, wanted to hold the Festival of Life. Sort of like you're doing right now, the Peace Rally, the Festival of Life, Happiness. This is when Jerry Rubin, Anita Hoffman, and Nasty Kershon and I created the myth of the Yippies. I'm gonna read you a statement from Yip, as we sometimes refer to Yippies as the Youth International Party, mainly so that they would take us legitimately as some sort of organization. So this is just to give you a little idea of what the Yippies we're all about. Join us in Chicago in August for an international festival of youth, music, and theater. Rise up, abandon the creeping meatball. Come all you rebels, youth spirits, rock minstrels, truth seekers, peacock freaks, poets, barricade jumpers, dancers, lovers, and artists. It is summer and it is the last week in August and the National Death Party meets to bless Lyndon Johnson, and we are there. There are 50,000 of us dancing in the streets, throbbing with amplifiers and in harmony. We are making love in the parks. We are reading, laughing, singing, printing newspapers, groping, making a mock convention, and celebrating the birth of a free America in our time. Everything will be free. Bring blankets, tents, draft cards, body paint, Mr. Leary's cow, food to share, music, eager skin, and happiness. The threats of LBJ, Mayor Daley, and J. Edgar Frico will not stop us. We are coming in from all over the world. The life of American spirit is being torn asunder by the forces of violence. Decay from the napalm cancer fiend. We demand the politics of ecstasy. We are the delicate spores of the new fierceness that will change America, and we will create our own reality. We are free America, and we will not accept the false theater of the death convention. We will be in Chicago, begin preparations. Now is Chicago, do it. All right, so you might ask, what is a Yippie? Have you ever heard of a Yippie before? Come on now, have you heard of a Yippie? Let me hear you make some noise. All right, so you ask, for the rest of you, what is a Yippie? A Yippie was someone that was going to Chicago. And who is a Yippie? Whoever wants to be. Now, you can ask at this point whether or not I had the intention of inciting a riot. Well, before you side with Richard J. Daley, let me give you a little quote that Richard gave during a press conference in Chicago. He said, "The police are not here to create disorder. The police are here to preserve disorder." Quote, end quote. Let me just say that Chicago was not my first experience. Protests and assembly. 1960 was when I consider myself as being born. psychologically, that is. I was fighting for the war against racial inequality from 1960 to 1965, and from 63 to 65 was the Paris moment that will never be recaptured. In Worcester, Mass, it was an Irish priest, a Jewish salesman, that's me, and a hungry black law student. Sounds like the beginning of a who walked into a bar joke. But we headed up what became known as the most militant NAACP chapter in the country at that time, and even the national office threatened disenfranchisement. You know, we would kind of work in and around the structure of the NAACP. If it became too encumbersome, we would go outside of it and only use the name and the mantle for respectability. And ironically, the first tough battle that we had was against this factory, this defense plant where I once had worked, considering the early days as a proletariat. They had 3,600 employees, and 33 of whom were African American. 32 of the 33 were janitors, and the 33rd was the janitor's straw boss. So the whites entered the plant as janitors and passed on. And only the African Americans remained to pick up the shit. As we campaigned for equal jobs, even my father called me and shouted, "Why them of all people? They're my best customers." As you know, probably here in Fresno, organizing in a smaller community is a lot different than a big city like New York or Los Angeles. You know, the local paper will print your address and your background. Organizing in the place where you were raised makes it more personal. Threatening phone calls for me were a common occurrence. I don't know about you. Picture this. All right, the picket lines at the factory have failed to effect a policy change on equality for the jobs. So the protesters and I, we decide to crawl under a diesel truck and prevent it from entering the factory. The oversized tires are towering above us and the grease is smudging up our shirts. And you can hear the paddy wagons arriving. And some workmen screaming, "Jungle bunnies, commie bastards, go home to Russia." And through the dim comes the voice of the plant's personnel manager. And he's leaning under the truck and he's shouting, "Abby, your father's here. He wants to have a word with you. Can you come out for a second?" All my friends say, "No, don't go." And I gotta go. My pa's got a bum heart. This is his best customer. I don't know what to do. So I say, "Hold the place for me. I'll be right back." And I sneak through all of the hecklers and get over to my father. And he says, "Okay, okay. So this is what you believe in. But did you have to get your shirt so dirty?" It's okay, you feel free to laugh. It was funny, my shirt was pretty greased up from the tires. Look, I took the segregation fight down south where, you know, the segregation was all too real. They still had signs in the mid-60s, "No colored served here." They had drinking fountains, one foot lower than the other. They had barrels in Wall, Mississippi, where they were supposed to stick their head in if they felt they had the need to laugh, and they had to leave the sidewalk if whites were walking by. It was a crazy time, and I was there fighting the fight. In June of 64, a group of three organizers went to check out a church in the northeast side of the state, and they didn't return. They found the car a month later. It was burned to a crisp. They were found in 13 feet of freshly poured cement. They were shot, but before they were shot, all their bones were broken with chains. You know, we had a protest march, and 3,000 of us got arrested. And they drew white lines and herded us into a field into makeshift jails. And when I got out of there, I flew directly north. And it was not often that any organizers wanted to come down south. But the next year, I got arrested another 4 times, you know. It was worth the fight. That was where my early protest started. Now at this point, you're probably wondering, "Hey, Abby, are you crazy or just stupid? What were you doing putting your life in danger for your beliefs, for going after equality and peace?" Look, I didn't start my days as a cultural revolutionary. I was a civil rights actionary until I was 24, which is already after I graduated from college. Yeah, that's right. This crazy guy yelling at this microphone, wearing an American flag as a t-shirt, went to college. I was taught by some of the best professors that were from a host of different institutions, thanks to Joe McCarthy's witch hunts of 1953. He didn't want to seem anti-Semitic, so he went after all the schools except for Brandeis. So that's where I went to study, and all the teachers came down there. Most of all, I loved Professor Abe Maslow. I took every class that he gave and spent long evenings with him and his family, and he taught humanistic psychology, which at the time was considered radical. Maslowian theory laid a solid foundation for optimism and for the 60s existential, altruistic, and upbeat teachings. I mean, that was my personal code. Realizing, you will, that the anti-intellectual chapter of my American life, I've always claimed that I got my ideas from watching television. That, of course, was a put-on. Nobody ever learned anything from watching television. I studied with the gurus of the 50s. Listen, I've always been good at creating myths. I mean, I started the myth of the Yippies, and a few of you know what I'm talking about. The most important thing to realize, especially with television, is that structure is more important than the content of the transmission of information. Remember that presentation is more important than what you're trying to do. So we all have really good ideas, but you have to figure out how you're going to spread those ideas, because the structure is more important than the information. TV is the greatest example. What is the purpose of television? Really, what is the purpose of television? I mean, America has more televisions than toilets. Why? I don't know. I mean, I guess if one of us could figure out how toilets could make more money than TV, then they'd probably change it and there'd be more toilets than televisions. Well, you ever hear about my story at the stock exchange? Anyone? All right. At the stock exchange, thank you. At the stock exchange, I'm the reason they put up the bulletproof glass around the gallery. I went there with Jerry Rubin and a dozen other free spirits. We took the tour. We weren't trying to act too crazy. I mean, I guess we were dressed a little bit crazy, and that was a bit conspicuous. But we asked if we could go into the gallery, and they didn't let the media in, and they couldn't really deny us. And I had 300 single dollar bills that I gave to all of my friends, and we started throwing them over the banister of the gallery, and all the stockbrokers, pandemonium struck, and they all started scrambling to pick up this money, which in essence is what they were already doing anyway. And it wasn't more than 2 weeks later that they spent $20,000 to put up bulletproof glass to cover the banisters so that no one could throw anything onto the stockbrokers. Oh, those are good times back then. On April 15th, we had a march, one of the biggest. It was 700,000 people that marched to the UN. It was three times the amount that had gone to Washington to boost the civil rights movement in 63. But it wasn't really notable. There wasn't a lot of media coverage. You probably haven't even heard about that peace march. There was a bunch of things that I did. I think this was the one that landed me being a part of the next peace march, is that in Valentine's Day of 1967, was a special one. For the celebration, I concocted a gift of love. I selected 3,000 people at random from the phone book, and I sent them all a card, and inside of it was a rolled marijuana cigarette, with a card saying, "Happy Valentine's Day. This cigarette contains no harmful cancer-causing ingredients. It is made from 100% pure marijuana." Directions followed on how to smoke it so that the recipients could decide for themselves and cut through all the baloney and, you know, whether or not they wanted to smoke it. Oh, and there was a postscript. At the bottom it said, "Oh, by the way, the possession of this item you are now holding in your hand can bring you up to 5 years in prison. It matters not how or whom you got it from." Now dig this. the news in New York. There was Bill Jorgensen at the time. He was the newscaster. And he was the perfect straight guy. So he reported on this. And he says, you know, because the press reacted as if killer weeds were plaguing New York. And he says, "Good evening, I'm Bill Jorgensen, and this is reefer." Many people, thousands of people in New York, have received this illegal substance referred to as marijuana. Thousands of unsuspecting citizens, and the police have set up a special hotline number for them to call with complaints. And then they said they were going to call the number later in the show. So at the end of the show, these two trench coat goons show up looking like they're from Dragnet. And they start asking Bill Jorgensen questions. Bill's like, "Oh, you're the police. That's right. I seem to have got this in the mail. What was the time of day? Morning. Well, what was your name and address? Well, my name is Bill Jorgensen. We need to see some ID. Well, can't you see? It's my show. My name is right there, my picture. We still need to see some ID. Well, what about this business about the reefer being, you know, a possible prison sentence? I don't know. You're going to have to talk to the DA about that." And then he says, "Well, that's all we have time for." I kid you not, New Jersey, a radio program reported that he had gone to jail for his little speech on television because he had the reefer in his hand. TV was an amazing, amazing way for us to spread our message. And we moved the protest from the streets to the TV. But we did things like we went to a peace march to the Pentagon. We went from Washington to the Pentagon with 100,000 people, and we told them that we were going to levitate it 300 feet in the air. Of course, we could only get a permit for 10 feet, which that was fine. So we were going to levitate it and exorcise all the evil spirits out of it. I'm sure you remember the Pentagon. You remember my friend, he put a flower in the barrel of one of the MP's rifles. That was that day at the Pentagon. We got a lot of press for that one, but it was time to go bigger and better, and that's when we moved to Chicago in the summer of 68. We applied for the permits in the proper fashion, but they stalled us, and then Mayor Daley, he completely said that we couldn't sleep in the parks. And then every night, they kicked us out at 11, they beat us down, they tear gassed us, and each night for five consecutive nights, we had more and more people come to protest. And that's what led us to the trial of the Chicago 8, when on the last day, the Wednesday, we had 20,000 people that gathered, and the news played 18 minutes of the police beating down 20,000 protesters. So look, I could explain the trial to you, but that would take all of this week and next week. I made a movie about it. It's called The Chicago 8. We just shot it last year, you know, considering that I came all the way from 1968 to be here. I figured I'd come here and I'd also shoot a movie. So I'll leave you with this. If people were forced to eat what they killed, there would be no more wars. Thank you very much. Abby Hoffman.